Now stay tuned for the Sunday Morning Wake-Up Call on 94.7 WPVC-LP Charlottesville. The Wake-Up Call is brought to you by Tiger Fuel and the markets of Tiger Fuel. Now here's your host, Rick Moore.
It is the Sunday Morning Wake-Up Call with Sean McCord, your reliable monthly, more or less, host, sitting across from Sean Decker. Sean Decker was a guest on the Wake Up Call in 2006, back when I was, my job was even more important than host, when I was the producer. We've been Facebook friends since. I think we've probably run into each other a couple of times, although you might not remember. But I remembered you and I remembered your story. And I just thought it would be interesting to have you come back on and kind of remind us who you are and why you were on the show 10, 11 years ago, and also what your life has been like since. So when you were on the Wake Up Call back in our old location, in our old studio, you would just come out with a book called My Pet Virus. Let's start there. Let's just talk a little bit what the book was about, what brought you on the show then, and then we'll try to pick up that thread.
Yeah, I mean, the book was basically, you know, pretty much a humorous look at the first 30 years of my life. I think I wrote the last stories that were in My Pet Virus when I was 29, and then after that it was like editing and everything. You know, it was a couple years before it was published.
And the virus in the title, My Pet Virus, refers to?
Yeah, it refers to HIV. I was diagnosed with HIV when I was 11, and didn't really talk about it till I was 20. And then at 20, I put up a website and called it My Pet Virus, which is like a little line in a Nirvana song.
Right.
I own my own pet virus. I get to pet and name it. And so I was like, you know, that was a lyric that always kind of, you know, stuck in my head because, you know, as somebody who was then HIV positive, I'm still HIV positive, but I wasn't talking about it then. So anytime I heard something that I could kind of relate to, but I couldn't talk about it, I'd be like, oh yeah, I would instantly be like, yeah, okay, that lyric, even though it was probably written, you know, about something else, that lyric, I sort of took ownership of it. And so, yeah, when I put up a website, it was kind of like that had always stuck in my head. And then when it came time to, like, write the book, I was like, well, I know what I want to call it. I want to call it My Pet Virus.
Yeah. I mean, you were diagnosed with HIV when you were 11 years old. Now, I want to get the terms right here. You were born with hemophilia.
Yes.
So you were getting, it's not blood transfusions, it was blood, help me with
blood
this.
Blood product treatments.
Blood product treatments, thank you.
Yeah.
See, I tried to make a mental note of all this. And this is back in the 1980s when the blood product industry was not as good about screening these things. And during one of those treatments, from somewhere, you contracted the HIV virus. Now, at 11 years old, you were already dealing with your hemophilia, already dealing with a genetic disease. And then suddenly you have this virus introduced. Now, I'm trying to think back, you know, 11 years old, I was in sixth grade. I was still trying to figure out who I was. I was trying to figure out how to talk to girls.
Mm-hmm.
And you've got all these added layers on top of that. So, I mean, your entire life, you've been dealing, we've been dealing with the hemophilia, and now you've been dealing with the HIV. So you wrote, as was revealed in your book and in your conversation in 2006, and as we were talking about just before you came on air, when you got the diagnosis, the doctors, the prognosis was not good back then in the 1980s.
Yeah. Yeah. It was, my parents, when I tested positive, they were told that, you know, cause I think my mom was probably pretty adamant about like, well, what does this mean?
You know,
with hemophilia, it was like, she pretty much, became an expert on it when I was, you know, when they found out that's why I was having these uncontrollable bleeding episodes.
Right.
They finally figured out when I was two, you know, what is this? What's it called? And so, you know, my parents had been following along you know, HIV AIDS stories in the media because, you know, one of the initial high risk groups were people with hemophilia. So many people were testing positive. So yeah, the word she got was 6 months to 2 years to live. And then for her, me being 11, being in sixth grade, when I tested positive, her goal was to see me through to high school graduation and do everything in her power to help me stay healthy. There weren't any effective treatments then. So, you know, it was probably considered a bit of a long shot.
So, spoiler alert. That was 30 years ago.
Yeah.
You have since graduated high school.
I'm working on it. It's a Billy Madison situation.
you're a musician, you're an author, you're an HIV educator, and you've been in a monogamous relationship for, I say, 13 years.
Oh, geez, we got together in 99.
Oh,
so,
okay.
We've been together, you know, we were married in 2004, but we always consider like 99.
Okay.
You know, cause we started living together and then we started traveling all over the country, like educating about HIV and, you know, Gwen's HIV negative, I'm HIV positive. So she was an educator before we met. That's how we met, through our HIV education. You know, AIDS Services Group put us in contact when she had contacted them looking for somebody to share their personal experiences living with HIV.
Yeah. And I've heard her story a few times that she wasn't, you know, she met and fell in love with you. She was already an HIV educator, and then the two of you met, and she hadn't been planning a life spent with someone who is HIV positive, but she had the background, she had the education.
I think that helped. You know, a lot of people who don't know anything about HIV, like when they fall in love with somebody who is positive, it's a long period of like kind of understanding what that means. Overcoming some fears, learning how it is and isn't transmitted, and it's a learning curve, and a lot of people get over it. But yeah, Gwen had the added advantage of knowing all that. But she also had the thing of like, wait, I've been educating about this. I never thought this would happen. You know, she's kind of like, you know, kind of taken off guard. But then she quickly realized, like, of course, this is no big deal. I mean, I remember when I first started speaking out about being positive, and I put up the website, and you know, I was 20 years old, and you know, one of my friends from high school who was a few years younger, she's very supportive. All my friends were when I went public. You know, I started writing for Pos Magazine and kind of was like making all these jokes and just like, you know, so comfortable with it. But I remember, like, she asked me, like, would you date somebody with HIV? And I remember, like, it gave me pause, because suddenly it was like, whoa, I knew the right thing to say was yes, but I had to like think about it, you know, which was crazy. It was crazy, but it's real stuff. It's like, I thought, like, geez, would I be able to deal with that emotionally? Like, how would I be able to be there for them?
Right.
Which is like a 20-year-old would think about those things. Like, am I up to the challenge, you know? And then, you know, if you look at what you've been through and what you know, you realize like, oh yeah, I am up to it. But it took me a little time before I was like, I wanted to answer honestly. I was like, yeah, if I fell in love with somebody, because you fall in love with people and it's like, we all fall in love with people and we find out something, it's like, that's no big deal.
Right.
I'm in love. Like, this person's awesome. Like, that's interesting, you know? Because you heard something like a stranger's dealing with this, you'd be like, what's going on there? But when you fall in love, it's like you're just so much more open, and you're open to share what your obstacles are and what you've overcome.
And, you know, we all have things.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, I mean, I've got asthma. And I've had asthma since I was a kid. So there are certain adjustments that I have to make in my life, and there's certain things that I know I can't do, or a certain pace that I have to keep myself. But I've never had to come out. I've never had to be an asthma educator.
Yeah.
You know, I've never had to, you know, introduce myself to people that way. to be honest, Sean, even just talking a little bit about right now on the radio, I'm a little uncomfortable just because, you know, it's a private thing. But it doesn't define who I am. You've made the decision early on that you were going to be open about your HIV and then use it to educate people. So what is it? What do you think it is? It's about HIV that puts you in a position to make that kind of decision. Is it because it's so little understood? Is it because it was a new disease that, you know, was defined, you know, in my lifetime? Or is it because of the stigma, various stigma that have been attached to it?
The reason why it's, a hot button issue?
Yeah.
I think it's because, you know, it's connected to sex, you know?
Right.
It's like, you know, there's some taboos in terms of people being willing to kind of acknowledge, sex and talk about what it means in their life. And, you know, a lot of people who are conservative are like, it's only for procreation. Oh, really? Is it really? Is that how you utilize it in your life? And then it's like, okay, well, the subject's about to get changed. You know, people don't really want to address, you know, what it means to them because they're afraid it's the wrong answer. And I feel like if people were more open and honest and willing to talk, there'd be less risky sexual behavior because people would learn what's safe and what's not, regardless of who you are. So it's that. It's, you know, it's also, too, in the early days, it was, you know, and even now, it's like, you know, one of the huge ways it's transmitted is IV drug use.
Right.
I mean, that's always been a problem. So, okay, you're talking about drug use and you're talking about sex and then you're attaching a medical condition to those two things. And people, like, from the beginning were like, well, that
just don't
those do, are terrible things.
Just people, don't do those things, and you won't you won't get that disease.
Yeah,
and yet here you are.
yeah.
Now, do you think within the HIV education community, especially in the early days, you were treated any differently because you got the disease when you were 11 years old? I'm going to assume you weren't sexually active.
Yeah.
and that you got the virus because you were being treated for another disease.
Yeah, it's interesting. You know, there is some of that, you know, where it's like you get, you know, preferential treatment. You know, I remember when I first started speaking out, people would ask, well, how'd you get it? And I'd just talk about hemophilia and the 80s blood supply and that type of stuff. And like, oh, I'm so sorry. Give me a hug. And I always wondered, like, you know, I made a lot of friends when I spoke out. I made a lot of friends who are HIV positive, who had contracted in every way you can contract HIV. And I never distinguished myself from them. You know, it was always kind of like we're all in the same boat. Like, I really identified with the gay community, even though I'm straight. In those years, I wasn't speaking about it because I was like, hey, that community knows. That community is no different than the hemophilia community. Like, people sitting around, looking around at people like them and watching them die. Like, that's a horrible situation, but it's also one that's bonding. It's like, oh, yeah, we know what this is like. Oh, yeah, we do, too. So I never felt this distinction, you know, but yeah, like there's been treatment different because I was diagnosed as a kid, but also too, like, you know, I got kicked out of school, like, you know, in Waynesboro, there were some issues, like I had friends' parents who wouldn't let me like spend the night anymore. It was like, so when it's like preferential treatment, it's like, okay, well, maybe I've gotten some passes, but I've also been hammered by the stigma, like, and my family has too, in very serious ways.
So there was, I remember in the 80s, I'm a little older than you, then in the 1980s, I was in my 20s, in the Reagan era. And we remember a national conversation about a young man named Ryan White, who is, I guess, a few years younger than you.
He was 2 years older.
Than you.
Yeah.
Wow. Yeah. So,
but it's that thing. It's like he's always, you know, viewed as the kid, that the country and the world met.
Right, because he too was kicked out of school, and his family was ostracized because he had HIV. So you're coming along a couple of years later. You're not getting the same kind of attention, but you must have been aware of Ryan Wright and the conversations that were going on around him. And the issue at the time. I mean, I guess what I'm trying to get to, what was it like for you at 11, 12 years old. And did you feel like you were part of a larger conversation?
Then I didn't really, like, I wasn't following Ryan White's story. Because, you know, before I tested positive, I didn't really know what AIDS was.
Right.
I didn't know it was something like I had to worry about. You know, I thought hemophilia was like the only medical condition I'm going to have.
Mm-hmm.
After I was diagnosed, that's when I started to notice, like, the People magazine, Ryan White stuff, like, you know, like my mom really started to follow his story then, and he was public. So it was like, he would be on Donahue, he'd be on like talk shows. Mm-hmm. You know, he was out there just really breaking down a lot of the stigma, and he really helped a lot of people who, you know, were struggling with wanting to learn more, to be sympathetic in any way to people with HIV, like Ryan White. You know, he said, like, you know, he's amazing. Like, if you just go back and read, you know, if you read now what he said then, it's like, wow, he was saying, like, you know, hey, I'm no different than anybody else. And he was basically saying, don't treat gay people differently. Like, you know, and when it's coming from a kid, I think anybody has to be like, wait a second here. Am I being a jerk about this? You know, like, he really made people kind of step outside themselves, look at themselves and be like, am I being a good person here? You
yeah.
know?
Yeah.
And so, yeah, he did a lot. He did so much to get people to sort of flip how they were feeling about it. I mean, some people never will, but he definitely, you know, it's hard to change people's minds, but I think he did.
Well, and at the very least, he brought the conversation to the national stage.
Yeah, in a different context than people were used to hearing.
In a completely different context, right? Exactly. So, so what happened to you? So you had to leave school,
mm-hmm.
And were you home educated then?
No, it was like there was the sixth grade school year. I tested positive in it was February or March. I recently like kind of looked it up because I was like, oh, this is, you know, this year's like the 30 year anniversary. And so like, I was yeah. like, looked it up. I was positive. My parents hadn't really told too many people about it outside of my immediate family. And then the school year was about to end. There was a couple weeks left. I'd been missing a lot of school that year. And, my mom, you know, she wanted to let the school know why I was missing so much school and that I tested positive. And as a result, you know, like my teacher talked to her doctor, it's like small town, you know, I was, the superintendent found out, I was called to the office one day and my mom picked me up and that was my last day of school. And so I missed the last 2 weeks of school because I'd basically been kicked out of school for testing positive for HIV. So that whole summer, my parents were fighting to get me back into school, and then I started junior high school on the normal thing, so there wasn't any need for homeschooling.
Okay, thank you. That I was a little unsure of that little mm-hmm. gap in your history. My guest is Sean Decker. This is Sean McCord. You're listening to the Sunday Morning Wake-Up Call. This is Sean McCord on 94.7 WPVC. WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. My guest is Sean Decker. Sean is an HIV educator. And Sean, as I mentioned at the top of the show, you were a guest on the Sunday Morning Wake of Call back in 2006 upon publication of your book, My Pet Virus. Now, you had been writing for some time on your website, My Pet Virus, which is still out there. I looked it up this weekend. It's been a little while since it's been updated.
Yeah, totally. I'm like, I should just redirect that to my Facebook page or something.
Yeah, yeah, that's okay.
There's a lot of cyber house cleaning that
we all need to do. I've got a blog out there that yeah. I post on maybe once or twice a year.
Yeah,
just to kind of remind people that it's still there. I doubt anyone is still subscribed to my RSS feed.
Gotta work. Gotta yeah. hit the pavement.
yeah. And of course, the book is still out there. I should mention that you can still get the book.
Yeah,
And it's available now on Amazon Kindle.
Yeah.
I was actually looking for my copy from 10 years ago. I was going to glance through it, and I'm ashamed to say I couldn't find it.
Yeah,
I've got
yeah.
too many books at home, but you know, if it was on my Kindle, I could find it right away.
Yeah, absolutely.
So I'll probably re-download it. So let's talk about your writing, because you're a writer, and that's something I admire. You started writing. You launched your website, My Pet Virus.
Mm-hmm.
Gosh, that was 20 years. You were like 20 when you launched.
Yeah,
that, right?
Yeah, 1996.
Yeah, yeah. How about that?
Yeah,
yeah. Did it have frames?
Yeah, it was a hot mess. But it was like, you know, I like had a friend show me some HTML, and I was able to like kind of update it on the fly, and mm-hmm. I was my own webmaster, and yeah, it was exciting. It was kind of like if I had a thought, it's like I could put it up on my website, and
right.
the thought that anybody around the world with a decent internet connection and the willingness to search a little bit, things were a little bit harder pre-Google to find, but. You know, I found pretty much every accessible, like, site by somebody with HIV in 96. Like, when I went on, I was expecting the internet of today, you know? I was uh-huh. like, oh, I'm ready to talk about this. Great. The internet, okay, everybody says the World Wide Web.
Yeah.
Oh, my gosh, there's going to be, like, hundreds of other sites that you're out there and I can learn some information. There are, like, four or five, you know? And that's when I realized, like, wait, I need to create what I'm looking for. So, you know... I was like blown away. I was like, wow. But also too, I was like inspired because I was like, I know what I need to do now. Like mm-hmm. I need to put up a website.
Mm-hmm.
And it was like, I was really kind of nervous. I was like, I don't really know many AIDS statistics. You know, I'm not a scientist. I'm not a medical professional. And I was like, wait, just be you. Like uh-huh. you're not any different. Don't change just because you're talking about this. And it was like, I didn't even know I liked to write, but when I started writing under, you know, that mindset of like, I'm not a professional, I'm just a 20-year-old living in Waynesboro, Virginia with HIV, like, that's when the funny stuff started coming out and all these thoughts I'd had that were like kind of sixth sense of humor type stuff coming out. And I just remember like typing those things and like laughing and just thinking like, oh my God, like somebody in Beijing might stumble upon this and read it. I might have to explain some of the cultural references, a lot of pop culture references when I was 20. I don't use so many anymore, but yeah, it was exciting. It was really cool. But yeah, today the internet, you search people with HIV in Google or you go to POS magazine or HIV Plus or any of these other AIDS magazines and you just find blog after blog by people with HIV. So it's really easy to find voices in the community now, which is awesome.
So at the time, I mean, it was, I think maybe you didn't even realize how unusual it was to have someone who was HIV positive out there talking about the virus, talking about it in kind of a, you know, a humorous manner,
mm-hmm.
Because it was such, you know, it was such a serious subject and we had spent such a long time not dealing with it.
Mm-hmm.
It was one of those areas where you're not supposed to make jokes about that.
Yeah.
But you know, it was your writing style is very self-deprecating.
Mm-hmm.
I think you're a humorist at heart.
Yeah.
And this is just what you choose to write about because this is what you know about. When did things like POS magazine, when did that first emerge? When did that first start publishing?
POS magazine, I believe they started in 94.
Okay. So
yeah.
Around the same time, maybe a couple of years earlier.
Yeah. Yeah. And it was, you know, when I, you know, I told my mom I was going to be speaking about HIV and she's like, I knew you would when you were ready. I was like, yeah, you're lying. You didn't see this one coming. But my doctor, I think, was really, you know, taken aback. He kind of was like, whoa, really? And so one of the first things he did was, you know, send me some issues of POS magazine. Uh-huh. And I was like, whoa. Like, and maybe reading POS magazine, like looking back, I think that made me think there was so much on the internet because they had like, each issue then had like four columnists who were sharing their personal stories. And it was great because it was like, oh, this person's life is different. And it's not because of HIV, it's because they have a different, like, you know, mentality just about life. You know, there were some that were like very funny, dark humor. And then there were others that were more kind of like serious about it, which was cool because I could relate to bits of all of it. So yeah, Paws Magazine, and that was very exciting. It was like I wrote a fan letter to the editor-in-chief, Sean Strube, one of the founders. And yeah, when he called, you know, when he called the house and invited me up to New York to be interviewed, that was like, that was crazy. So yeah, I started the website in 96, and then in 97 I was writing for the magazine.
Now,
so
for our younger people in the audience, magazines were these things that were printed on paper with glossy covers. Yeah. And they used to distribute them at these things called newsstands.
Yes.
And apparently doctor's offices.
Yeah. So, yeah, just go on your computer, go to a website, hit print, and do that. Do that about, you know, 25 times, staple it together, and go try to sell it to a friend.
Yeah, and that's yeah, amazing.
And if they buy it, sign them up for a subscription and cut them a deal.
Yeah, yeah. But back in the day, it was a big deal to get that kind of information. So you're a young man, you're in your early 20s, you get invited up to New York. You're interviewed for the magazine. Then when did you start writing for them? Shortly afterwards?
Yeah. It was about a year after I decided to start speaking out about HIV. It was very quick.
By the way, it's still out there. The Paws magazine is still. Yeah. It's POZ.
Yeah, POZ.com. And right. Yeah, like I still write for them and do some work for them, which is cool.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, they've been like, you know, they've been a big part of my life. Like, you know, I'll always be connected to Paws. The people there, and still there, like great people have always been associated with it. So I feel like a sense of pride that like, oh, this handwritten letter I sent, like kind of, you know, people there, like, oh, responded to it. And then as I learned more about it. Yeah, totally.
So, like you had to write it on paper and then stick it in an envelope,
put a
stamp on it. And,
yeah. Wow. Well, you know, I just went up and visited, Sean, who had gotten the letter, and he said it was typed out and printed and mailed.
All right.
Yeah.
All right.
So there's like, yeah, totally. I was like, oh, I've been telling people because yeah, when the interview with me came out, it was like for this hemophilia issue of Paws.
Mm.
And I remember Sean got mad because some editor said that I'd emailed him a letter introducing myself. Mm. And he was like, no, he mailed it. And so I further screwed up the story because I was like, yeah, I hand wrote a letter. And then I just found out last summer, he was like, no, like you typed it out, but you put a stamp on it and mailed it. And he was like, that's what I was mad about. You didn't email it.
There we go.
But it was typed out like it was an email.
Maybe you hand addressed the envelope.
Exactly. I don't think I would have gotten a call back if I'd handwritten it because he wouldn't have been able to understand any of it. So it's a good thing I was professional.
Yeah. Yeah. So, you know, back in those days, I mean, it was important to bring HIV and AIDS into the national conversation. It was something, as we touched on a few minutes ago, my guest, Sean Decker, HIV educator, it was, in you know, back in those days, people didn't want to talk about it. And as you mentioned earlier, because of the stigma, because of associated not just with sex, but it was associated with homosexual sex,
mm-hmm.
and with drug use. And, you know, you were one of the good ones because you had hemophilia. So you got in during the treatment. For people who don't remember this, Ronald Reagan was in the White House for 8 years. I think it was in his eighth mm-hmm. year when he finally talked about AIDS.
Mm-hmm.
He never even mentioned the word, and that was, you know, this is when the epidemic was really erupted.
Yeah.
When, as a young person in my 20s, I was confused about the information, and I was, you know, college educated guy living on the West Coast, and mm-hmm. even I had a hard time knowing exactly what was going on.
Yeah.
And it's, you know, it's when you brought it up, people just didn't want to hear it. So it was important, even in this period in the 90s, to have this conversation, to keep bringing it back, to keep talking about it. Now you've been an HIV educator for over 20 years. Do you find that the conversation has changed? Are people still talking about HIV? And if they're not talking about it, is it because they don't want to talk about it anymore or because they've moved on?
I think the conversation has changed because, you know, you don't see things on the news about it. It's not kind of out there in people's faces the way it was in the 80s and early 90s. You know, it's just one of those things where it's like, you know, what people hear about it is... It's like two different things. It's like either people kind of understand what the reality is for people who have access to treatment. Mm-hmm. They understand, oh, yeah, there's treatment for this. People can live, you know, a pretty normal life. Or they think, like, if you get this, you have no chance.
Right.
And a lot of people who test positive are people who are like, oh, yeah, if there are treatments out there. I know about it, you know, safe sex, this and that. But a lot of those people, when they test positive, they immediately go to the dark viewpoint that there's no hope, that they're going to die, that their life has changed, that they're going to be treated differently. The stigma that being treated differently is the most real concern because, you know, that the social stuff is really, you know, what affects people's mental health, depression, things that make people less likely to go to their doctor's appointment, the thing that makes people... not want to stay on their treatment. You know, a lot of those things, you know, the stigma definitely puts people's lives at risk. And that's a conversation that in the AIDS community that has come up a lot in recent years because, you know, so many people have been lost. You know, I mean, even here, like in town, like, you know, quite a few years ago, a few different friends were telling me, like, I got a friend that you should meet. I got a friend that, you know, I want to introduce you to. And I knew, like, their friend had tested positive.
Right.
And I talked to him, and he had a great attitude. And we were joking about starting an all HIV positive band together, playing on people's fears, you know, the ultimate punk rock band, you know. And then, you know.
The like, T-cells.
Yeah, exactly, exactly. So I was kind of like, oh, he's going to be okay. Like, he's on treatment. And then, you know, kind of lost a little bit of contact. He moved just out of Charlottesville. And then I found out he had passed because he got sick and he had fallen out of the, you know.
Fallen out of his treatment regime.
Yeah, and just the doctor's appointments. It was like there was just, I think there was, from what I understand, there was just was a change in locations and things probably shifted in his life. He wasn't seeing his doctor, maybe he didn't get the prescription refilled, just stuff like that is happening. And, you know, it's hard because those of us who are fortunate to have lived to the time of HIV treatment, you know, I got very sick in 1999. And if I didn't have access to HIV medication, I would have been, you know, dead within 6 months.
Yeah.
Like I lost like close to 40 pounds. My T cell count dropped down from, you know, around, you know, 150, 200, which is kind of low anyway, dropped down to like 38. Mm. Just all the lab results were just getting worse and worse each time. I understand that, like, I'm lucky. I'm lucky I got that sick at that time and was able to get on treatment. And I've been able to, you know, pretty much like be on successful treatment since then. It's hard. It's like, and part of that's because, you know, I have a really great support system in Gwen. I have friends, family who know the situation. I'm open about my status. So in a way I'm kind of safeguarded where even if I was, you know, in a period when I was depressed, it's like, there's no way I wouldn't be going to my doctor's appointments. There's no way I would just not have a prescription refilled. So I have a lot of safety nets and I'm aware, like I always have, I'm alive because I've been taken care of. And at this point in my life, it's like, you know, in the last, like, you know, 15 years, it's been about, okay, being more proactive about taking care of myself.
Sure.
And starting HIV treatment was a huge turning point for me.
My guest, Sean Decker, we're talking about his years as an HIV educator. The book that you published in 2006 is called My Pet Virus. The website is still out there. And what you're talking about now, having that kind of stability, I mean, that Sean right there is so important no matter what sort of demons are chasing us, you know, whether it be drug abuse, you know, alcoholism, homelessness, abuse in a relationship. I mean, all these things, and living with a virus as you have, all these things are what makes us be able to cope with these things is stability, is security, is having people in our lives who look after us. And when you don't have that, then all these, it doesn't even take a deadly virus. It can take it can take an addiction. It can take simply a medical setback, and suddenly your life can be completely disrupted. So, you know, you're part of a community. You mentioned your friend who passed a few years ago, who, you know, they've already got something stacked up against them. So I think the importance of talking about these things, the importance of talking about HIV and educating the community at large, is reinforcing the message that everybody needs that. Everybody needs stability. Everybody needs a foundation, a solid foundation upon which they can stand to help them deal with whatever's going on in their life. I mean, I too am very fortunate in that, you know, I have a wife, I have a family, I have a regular job. And, you know, people that I know, friends, people in my family who, for whatever reason, have had those underpinnings taken out from underneath them. It's so easy to fall into those holes. It's got to be that much more complicated when you have a medical condition where you need to see a doctor regularly and need to have regular treatments. And I think it's important to point out that there is no cure for HIV. What you're talking about is treatment. What you're talking about is regular regime that you have to go through. And do you mind talking a little bit about that? What your treatments are and what you have to do medically in order to live with your HIV?
Yeah, I mean, for me, it's very simple. I take, two pills with the first meal of the day, every day. And
that sounds complicated.
Yeah. And then every 6 months I go in to, you know, the Ryan White Clinic here at UVA,
right.
Named in his honor. Ryan White was somebody with HIV and hemophilia who educated a lot of people. He was diagnosed as a kid like me. A lot of education in the 80s, and he passed in 1990 for listeners just checking in. But yeah, it's like, you know, it's very easy. And when I started in 1999, it was like I was taking more pills. I was dealing with stomach issues, nausea, just everything. It was a different situation. Like, those medications worked. My T cells started to go up. My viral load started to go down, which was good. There's less viral activity in my body, but it was like I could feel, oh, these are powerful drugs. Yeah. They're affecting like how I feel. Like, they're doing their job, but they're doing a job on me too. Different story now. And each time I switched medications, not because they were ever working, but each time I switched, it was like the side effects got more manageable. But for me, quality of life was always important. And I have a great doctor at UVA who was always compassionate, always open. You know, he was nervous each time I wanted to switch, but he was also like, I want you to feel good. And it's like, okay, if you're going to switch, here's what I think you should be on, and this is why. So that's very important, too, having a good relationship with your doctor.
Well, I want to hear a bit more about how your life has changed in the past 10 or 11 years. My guest, Sean Decker. This is 94.7 WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. This is Sean McCord on the Sunday Morning Wake Up Call on 94.7 WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. My guest, the other Sean Decker, although you spell your name wrong, but I guess I guess that's your parents' fault. We can't hold you to that.
You say on Facebook you pronounce yours Sean.
Oh, I do that just to mess. I just to mess with people.
So you spell it wrong, and now you're telling people to say it wrong.
Well, that's true. Yours is definitely more phonetic. So you were a guest on the Wake Up Call in 2006 upon publication of your book, My Pet Virus. I've been following you for probably since then, or close to since then, on Facebook. And you're like an old time published author. and you're a musician. Tell us about your music, and also just how life has been for you the past 10, 11 years.
Yeah. I mean, I'm 42 now.
42?
Yeah, it's pretty awesome. For people just tuning in, I was diagnosed with HIV when I was 11.
By the way, for people just tuning in, sorry to interrupt, the entire show will be available on cvillepodcast.com. So you can always go back, if you're coming in late now, you can always go back and hear the beginning of the show. And I'm sorry. Go ahead.
No, but yeah, music. I mean, I'm in a synth pop band called Synthetic Division. I came up with the name, or I didn't come up with it, but it was like Algebra 1 Part 2 in high school, and studying Synthetic Division. I couldn't do it now, but I was like, that'd be an awesome
band awesome
name.
Yeah.
So yeah, I had like a senior class project, so the album that has never seen the day of light, like Synthetic Division, it was like, I used that name, and I've used it ever since. And music for me has like been very, very important in my life. I was diagnosed at 11, at 12 is when I really developed a love for music. Saw the Bangles in concert. They were my first like favorite band.
You saw the Bangles in
yeah,
concert?
Yeah.
Dude.
Yeah.
Oh, I still love them.
Oh, they're great. Yeah. I'm like, oh yeah, they were like my first favorite band. And my aunt took me down to Virginia Tech to see them in concert. They were playing like a campus gig in like 88. It was awesome. And then Depeche Mode, like I heard electronic music.
Right.
I'd always heard these like, these synth hits of the 80s, like Duran Duran, like Human League, Don't You Want Me Baby, all those songs. And I always was like, that music always appealed to me.
Mm-hmm.
And so when I heard Depeche Mode, I was like, whoa, what is this? And that really like, that inspired me to want to become a musician, to like ask for a synthesizer for Christmas. And I got like the top of the line synth, because that, we mentioned earlier, my original prognosis was like 6 months to 2 years. So
like, get the kid what he wants.
Oh yeah. We'll figure out how to make ends meet, we're just going to,
did you ride that horse for a while?
I did. I wasn't, I didn't know. Yeah, totally. I didn't know I was. And it was like, I look back now and it's like, oh my God, that thing was like $2,000.
Wow.
I don't know what happened there. I hope my brother didn't get shortchanged too much there. Sorry, I got a brother who's 2 years older than me.
So do you still have that synthesizer?
I do. I have one of them. I got like another one of the same, just because I saw one on sale like years ago,
right.
and grabbed it. But
right.
it's wonky. A friend,
They weren't made to last.
Yeah,
years.
Totally.
Yeah.
Like a friend and I played like a New Year's Eve gig with some other friends, local bands. We did like a pajama dance party at the Southern, and my friend Josh, he plays keyboards for me sometimes. Like we were gonna do this show, and we were like had our like vintage bathrobes that we were gonna wear on stage. We were so excited. We're like, oh man, it'd be so great if like you played a vintage synth. And we dug it out of the case from under my bed, like set it up, and we spent like an hour trying to get one sound on it programmed. And then Josh turned the synth on and turned it off and turned it back on.
You lost it.
We put the synth back under the bed and then just connected the MIDI keyboard to the computer, which has all the classic 80s
yes.
sounds, like thousands of sounds. But we just thought like, oh, vintage. Yeah, let's get a vintage synth on stage. That'd be awesome. Like, nah, it didn't work. But yeah, like, just back like having my favorite band, like, forming high school bands, like, playing, we were playing terrible music because we were learning our instruments.
Sure.
One way that HIV and that prognosis, got to do something cool was, my freshman year in high school, a few years after my diagnosis, 1990, that's when Ryan White passed, and my mom was following his story. Ryan White was a kid with hemophilia who tested positive, like me. He was kicked out of school. Unlike me at the time, he went public. It was a big deal, but he passed in 1990, and my mom got concerned that, oh, John's lived beyond his prognosis.
Yeah.
And so she contacted the Make-A-Wish Foundation, And they approved my wish, which was to meet Depeche Mode.
Really?
Yeah. So I was able to, with my best friend, we were able to, it was exams. We were able to like get a pass on our exams, take them at another time. We went up to DC, saw Depeche Mode, met them before the show.
Oh, wow.
Got our picture taken. I was so nervous. I was like, oh my God. So yeah, that was like, to me, that was like, meeting them was like, wow. Like, it kind of was like, man, anything in life can happen. I didn't look at it as like, this is my dying wish.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I always ran from the medical reality or the whatever the prognosis was. I was like, I'll deal with this when I get really sick. And I didn't want to think about it a day before. But
right.
Going through that and realizing this is happening because of this great organization called the Make-A-Wish Foundation.
Mm-hmm.
And I am somebody who is on borrowed time.
Right.
But it had the effect that I think it has for a lot of people, like, you know, a lot of people, like kids who are terminally ill, they're meeting their heroes, but like you see those pictures and it's like the celebrities are like beaming,
mm-hmm.
you know,
mm-hmm.
and the kids are beaming
mm-hmm.
and it's like, it's their reality.
Mm-hmm.
You know, a lot of them, they don't feel sorry for themselves. They're like, oh, this is awesome. I'm meeting somebody. Like, my family's taking care of me. Like, it's cool that this Make-A-Wish exists. So yeah, for me, it was like, wow, gosh, I met these legends. Oh my God. It was such a, too, it was like, how do they write this music? And then as I got older and got better at it.
Did you tell them that you were going to start a band someday called Synthetic Division?
Well, my friends at the time, you know, he's still like, you know, he's still like one of my best friends.
Mm-hmm.
My friend who met the band with me, he slipped their keyboard player one of our demo cassette tapes.
Of course he did.
Of course he did.
Of course he did.
When I found
what
out,
else are you going to do?
When I found out he did, because our friend who's like in the grade above us, we were playing music with him. He like told him, "You got to do this. This is our big break.
Yeah.
You know, don't tell Sean."
Yeah.
And I was like, "What? Oh my God, it's terrible. I'm had so many bad notes. Which songs did you? Oh my God, what are you doing?" And then, you know, when I was writing My Pet Virus and was thinking of these things I don't talk about when I'm out educating with Gwen, you know, I was kind of, my editor was like, well, what happened between this and that?
Mm-hmm.
And I really had to go back and, oh my God, when I remembered that, I was dying. I was like, thank you for slipping them the demo
yes.
tape, because that is a great story.
Yes, it is.
And it's like, if he was the one meeting his favorite band through the Make-A-Wish Foundation, I would have had that demo tape
absolutely.
In my pocket. Too.
Absolutely.
Hey guys, thanks for meeting my friend. Check out our awesome band. Next week we can get on this tour. We'll open the rest of the dates.
Yeah. Right. I mean, nowadays, you know, you just like friend them on Facebook or Twitter them your band camp.
Yeah.
Or whatever. But that, back then you had to actually physically hand them
yeah.
a cassette. Have you ever find yourself wondering, where's that cassette now?
Oh gosh, I hope they listened to it and had a good laugh.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
Be like,
yeah.
Oh my
God. So are you still in touch with the guys?
No, like that. Yeah. I mean, that happened. It was like, it was cool. Like, I, you know, I put the picture up in my locker.
Yeah,
it's like my first love. Like, yeah, she saw the picture. Oh my God, that like Depeche Mode was like one of her favorite band.
Yeah.
Oh my God, you met Depeche Mode?
Okay. So
oh, yeah, I did.
So again, for the young people in our audience, putting a picture in your locker is the equivalent of Snapchatting now.
Yeah, it's like your cover photo.
Right. So yeah. You actually have to walk people over to your locker, unlock it, open it up, and show it to them.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. So yeah, that was, but I didn't say like it was Make-A-Wish Foundation, you know.
No.
But
it's like, oh yeah, me and Depeche Mode. Yeah, we're just hanging out one day.
Yeah, totally. But a very cool thing happened. Like this year, I was kind of like, okay, this is 30 years since I tested positive. And so my idea going into this year was like, do a lot of really cool educational stuff. But
mm-hmm.
I didn't kind of set out to plan a lot. I kind of was like, okay, this is like, this is the day I was diagnosed 30 years ago. And I kind of like looked it up and posted on Facebook about it. And it was like, you know, kind of like, okay, I really want to educate people about this because it is like a 30 year, it's an anniversary. Those are big deals in anything.
Yeah.
People like will pay attention and read something. It's like, hey, 30 years ago, this. Depeche Mode had a new album come out this year, and they have a new album come out every few years, and it's like I buy it and I go see the band play, you know, wherever's closest or fun. And this year for their new album, they were like, you know, they're doing 365 days where a fan takes over their Facebook page. And so like Gwen was like, you need to submit to that. And I submitted to it. I was like, okay. And I like forgot about it. And I'm terrible on Facebook. Like friend, you know, I'll be talking to friends. I'll be like, they'll start in the middle of a story and I'll be wait, back up. What are you talking about? They're like, oh, well, I posted about this on Facebook. I'm like, never assume I'm seeing that. Like so many people must think I'm the worst friend ever. It's like, I didn't see that. You have three kids now? How's Jimmy? Jacob. It's like, oh shit, I'm terrible. so yeah, it's funny. But yeah, I got that word, you know, like when I totally forgot about it. And then I went to their site and I was like, oh geez, they've been doing this takeover thing for like, you know, 120 days.
Yeah.
I was like, I didn't see that. Gwen said, yeah, I was seeing that. I was wondering like, what's going on here? Why haven't they contacted Sean? It was funny. But yeah, like, so I was able to like, you know, this summer, post like, you know, four or five times from their page about HIV, about meeting the band, about my own music. And nice. It was cool because I was like, well, man.
I have to apologize. I didn't see any of that.
Yeah.
I don't think I'm on the Depeche Mode Facebook page very often.
Yeah, totally. But it was cool because it was like, I'm educating like this whole different group.
Yeah.
Like, and to me, that's the coolest thing about this year. It's been like there have been these things that have come up where it's like I didn't expect that to be a part of this year.
Mm-hmm.
And it's been cool because it's like I'm just living my life like and enjoying it. You know, like, you know, I'm an uncle, you know,
nice.
To two nieces, have a goddaughter who's 9 years old, you know, have friends doing the music. Everything with Gwen and I is going along well, and it's just like my life is awesome, you know. And it's like anytime I get a chance to do something that's fun and educational, it's like I always jump at it.
So, my guest Sean Decker. So, if we want to keep up with you, we should keep up with you on Facebook.
Yeah.
My Pet Virus is still out there. Synthetic Division, your website for your band, is out there and on Bandcamp.
Yeah, I mean, Bandcamp. If you just look up Synthetic Division,
mm-hmm. So we can listen to some of your music. So, but as you're looking back now, as you're looking back on 30 years of your diagnosis, and I remember, well, I don't remember. I went back and I re-listened to the show when you were on the wake of Colin 2006, and something that struck me, you were like 31 at the time. Something that struck me is that when you first came out and you started your website when you were 20 and looking back on, as a 20-year-old, looking back on that you had, your parents had initially been given a prognosis of 6 months to 2 years, and you know, now you were in your, now you were 20, and you had said to yourself, well, you know what, now I will consider it a full life if I just make it to 40. Now you're in your 40s.
Mm-hmm.
So as a gentleman, as a Southern gentleman in his 40s, looking back on your life, are there things that you wish you could go back and tell that 30-year-old or that 20-year-old or that 11-year-old when he was first diagnosed?
Yeah, I mean, you know, when I was first diagnosed, it'd be just like, hey, there's going to be moments when you're having to think about this, like, you know, somebody's going to tell the girl that you like that you have HIV and you're going to find out about it. And it's like, there's going to be these devastating things that happen and you're going to feel really scared. And it's like, just hang in there, which, you know, I kind of did, but there were times when it was like, man, I really was depressed about it.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
You know, and at 20, you know, like, you know, it's, when I decided to speak out, one of the things was like, oh, that was right when effective HIV treatments were out there. And yeah, at 20, I was like, man, I could be having my midlife crisis now. I could be alive for 20 more years. And that seemed daunting.
Yeah.
You know, like, what am I going to do to fill the time? 20 years. And now it's like, where did those 20 years go? And
yeah.
It's like, and then,
yeah.
You know, but it's awesome. And you know, at 30, when the book came out, I was like, I was pretty like, you know, I'd been educating for 10 years. Gwen and I had been together for about 7 years, and I had my feet under me. So at 30, it'd be like, don't go 2 years without writing a song, is what I would tell myself. Because, you know, for me, music is, like, you know, very important. And I like having, like, you know, I have these columns, I have these things, I, these talks Gwen I've done, there's this documentation. And for me, it's equally important to, like, have a musical legacy whenever I'm gone, which is, like, hopefully there's so many ways you can go in this world, you know? It's like, you know, however much time I have left is awesome, but it's like I want to have a legacy, you know, I want to have a written legacy in music and in word.
Well, and as we spoke about before we came on the air, you know, right now you just have to look forward to a normal lifespan. There are things that you're going to have to continue to deal with the HIV and with the hemophilia, just certain medical, you know, medical conditions that you're, that you just have to confront. But I mean, look at you, you're young, you're rocking that blonde hair, by the way.
Thank you.
You're in a successful relationship. You're doing your music. Any projects looming on the horizon? Anything that you say, yeah, this is the next thing I want to do.
Yeah.
In about 30 seconds.
Yeah. Working on a new album, writing the songs now. You know, I really like him wanting to get this word out. Search the hashtag U equals U. Basically,
and you know, spell that out for us.
The letter U, the word equals, and then the letter U.
Thank you.
And you can find it on Facebook. But basically, CDC, a lot of groups are behind it. Basically, if you're on HIV treatment and your viral load's undetectable, you still test positive for antibodies to the virus. But if you're on effective treatment, it's basically impossible to transmit the virus to somebody. And so I think that's going to increase testing. That's going to make people with HIV feel better, their partners feel better. And it's science, and science is fact. And in this day and age, we have to look at science. We have to look at facts and accept them, because they give people hope. You know, a lot of people operate in a factless world right now. It's like, we got to get away from that, you know?
My friend and guest is saying such controversial things as science is fact is Sean Decker. Sean, thank you so much for being here. Thank you so much for coming back on the show. I look forward to continuing to follow your adventures on Facebook. This is Sean McCord. I spelled my name right. You've been listening to the Wake Up Call on 94.7 WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville.
This has been the Sunday Morning Wake Up Call on 94.7, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. The Wake Up Call is brought to you by Tiger Fuel and the markets of Tiger Fuel. Production assistance and engineering from Sean McCord and Mike Friend. Be sure to join Rick next Sunday morning at 11 a.m. for the Wake Up Call, only on WPVC LP Charlottesville.